Hello, somebody just joined us.
Frank Nichols.
Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hey, guys.
So, you safe?
I'm
just concerned about everybody in the Baltimore area, that's all.
No, we're far, far away, unfortunately. So thank you for the concern.
Okay, so I just started the recording. So are there any announcements? Well, I'll just let everybody know, I think most of you do, but we did successfully get 11 ADU session proposals submitted by Wednesday. So that's 11 sessions and 28 conveners, so we did pretty well. We also got a AAAS Climate Literacy Collective Impact Symposium proposal submitted. So that was successful. And Frank and I, along with a bunch of other people, are going to be participating in a summit on the implementation of the NGSS in at the state level. And that starts tomorrow. So
in
those
DC.
Are my announcements.
Tamara, that's why you're going to D.C. today?
Yeah, that's why I'm flying down. Yes.
Good.
Tamara, do you know, were you on the advisory board for the summit?
No.
So it's a little unclear as to who, I still don't know who's going to be there.
I don't have a list of participants, but I haven't searched the website. There is a private workspace, but unfortunately, for whatever reason, I've had technical difficulties in getting in. So John McDerris sent out an email earlier today with a link saying you should be able to get in, and so I've emailed him that I can't, but you might look for yours, Frank, and see if you can get in. It might have a list of who's supposed
to be. I've tried the same thing and having the same problem.
Oh, okay. So, nope, can't say who's going to be there.
Gotcha.
I think it's on the order of, this is just based on a conversation with Susan Sullivan a few months ago, on the order of 30 people, but I don't know that for sure. Mm-hmm. Okay, so were any of you involved with the Climate Education Week or Earth Day events this past week?
We put a few posts or two on social media, and we had a speaker down at the conservatory here in town. So we did some other events. Actually, that was kind of the closing out of Bird's big season. Usually April's our big month because of Earth Day and Earth Week and what the university is now kind of renamed Earth Month, the series of events. And
mm-hmm.
So we're kind of cleaning up and trying to restock and get everything ready for summer workshops now that that's concluded.
How many people participate in that?
You know, it really varies by event. Some of our online audiences were bigger than our in-person audiences. You know, we had the speaker we had here that we had some audio issues for the first part. We had probably 30 people in attendance, but there were 180 online.
Mm-hmm.
That was earlier in April. And then the event that we had at the conservatory had a pretty small attendance that night because the weather just turned on us. But then we had 35 people that were online, so it was about 50 total.
Mm-hmm.
And there's kind of a series of events that was at the zoo this weekend. Unfortunately, we had cold weather again.
Are these online events that people listen, that they're just speakers that people listen to?
Yeah, we went ahead and did a simultaneous broadcast, and then we archive it with Sea Grant at OSU has a distribution listserv now. And
mm-hmm.
I think they have 33,000 people on the distribution list, so a lot of individuals will log in and listen to them later, even if they can't in person. So
mm-hmm.
we've been trying to partner with them or 4-H and a lot of the programs. We also had a really interesting development last week where periodically you have those times you go into a meeting and you kind of taken off guard. But our state climatologist in the state's changing. He's retiring. And Ohio hasn't had a funded position. But somebody from our center has kind of been tapped as the new state climatologist and really wants to play a more active role, and we're pursuing funding. But as part of that, we thought it would be good to engage the agricultural community. So we went to the first planning session for the Farm Science Review, and Ohio has one of the biggest, I think it's the big three farm reviews in the country where they showcase agricultural equipment, practices with extension that's hosted by a university, and still I think it's one of the top five in the country as far as size goes. And was kind of taken off guard. Was not really sure what kind of reception we'd have, and we were invited. I pursued this for a few months, and then we were invited to attend, and we had overwhelmingly positive support. A lot of interesting people want to collaborate, talk about displays, talk about speakers, have been trying to engage the state climatologist for a while on this, but it was kind of the opposite reception I had prepared for, which is maybe having to justify and explain what we do, and it was overwhelmingly positive. Now, it is a kind of an academic crowd. It's the university faculty and staff and researchers, in addition to some of the on-site staff that runs the facility that it's hosted at, but was a much different reception than I thought we might get.
And that was good. Farm science review, is that what you said it was?
Yes. So a lot of the big land-grant institutions run a farm showcase sometime during the season, usually in late summer. And this is, and some of them are run, I guess, by states as well as part of the state fair. But ours is one of the biggest in the country. And it's at a facility about 25, 30 minutes outside Columbus. And it's done by Ohio State with our extension agents. But it's also, Purdue contributes because Purdue, the state of Indiana, has theirs in the extreme western part of the state. And so they wanted to collaborate with us to provide something closer to farmers in the eastern part of the state.
And was your reception with respect to Ohio State or with the Byrd Polar Research Center, or what was the actual?
The university and our extension service run the event, but many people on campus know of us, but I guess we'd never really thought about calling over there and discussing what information we could contribute with climate, what information from the National Climate Assessment people wanted to know about. Are there certain things that need to be done that we could partner on? And so I think the name change made the connection more obvious, because we're climate, not just polar anymore.
Why don't you tell everybody what the name change was from and to?
Yeah. The our center used to be just a polar center in name, the Byrd Polar Research Center, and late last fall the university authorized a change to polar and climate, and it makes it a lot easier when you go into meetings to explain. If you come in, you say you're a climate center, it's a little more obvious, and they can think about what the connection is. If you say polar, it isn't as obvious, even if we had teams doing a lot of climate work at the center.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very pleasant meeting. A lot of potential impact due to that. We had some legislation passed in Ohio due to the Toledo water issue last summer, where farmers can't apply manure within so many hours. I think it's 24 hours of a large rainfall event anticipated. They don't know how to pursue that data, so one of the things that came out of this meeting last week was we actually could help work with some of the data coming out of the National Weather Service, get a display that would be statewide that would allow farmers to quickly see and maybe get a text message as to whether the conditions are favorable to fertilizing or if they really shouldn't. And that was it's really low-hanging fruit that would be very helpful to that community. But we had never, until you open those bridges and get the dialogue going, you don't see where those connections are. So it was a very exciting day for us to have that kind of reception there.
Great.
Jason, this is Scott. I'm curious why you anticipated a different kind of response. Was it just simply that you really hadn't had any experience with these folks? And so you sort of
No,
said, okay.
we have some deniers on campus in ag.
Okay.
Not high profile, but we have a few in places that I've come across myself and that I've heard of, and that and I know in the industry outside of the university there's some denial. And because of some of the students who attend here and what we hear about their local community they grow up in, and they'll just say, you know, based on where I grew up, this is, you have to explain, if you say something, if somebody asks you about climate change issues, they have a lot of questions, but usually they are very skeptical.
Uh-huh.
And so I didn't go in. I thought, first of all, many people wouldn't know why we were there or what we were able to contribute. And I thought maybe there is some pushback or some people that weren't sure of the connection that didn't say anything, but I just was overwhelmed by the warmth of the reception and the extent to which people were willing to think of creative ways to get the information out for the constituency that would be there.
This almost sounds like a turning point, doesn't it, in terms of certainly in Ohio, where now there are folks seeking out information from groups who have been doing a lot of climate research and the impacts.
We get a lot of calls. Well, it's part of the other reason that I work going is to try to get out front of stuff, because we're getting slammed with requests for visits and tours and stuff that's starting to outstrip demand. I could sit on my computer all day now and almost just field, and we have a graduate student here, field and try to set up all the tours for everywhere from legislators to the farming community to senior citizen centers from regional campuses. So there's a lot of interest in people trying to get information outside the mainstream media. And I expect that to only keep trending upward. I mean, Frank, you mentioned that call earlier this, like 2-3 weeks ago, that the trend is up for everybody. But try to hit a bigger audience in a really targeted venue when you have a 4-day event and you know they're going to be there. And maybe expand your 10 of people you're able to hit and impact.
Yeah.
SIDA will be there in more of a listening mode this year, really to maybe Q&A. They have an expert panel and some displays, and just kind of listen and feel out the vibe and what people are interested in. But I think being approached and told that the community really wants scientific information to help them know when they can legally apply fertilizer.
Yes.
We need help with that. Well, that always is a good olive branch if you can say, well, we have a deliverable that could help you do that.
Yes.
So
this meeting is an annual meeting?
Yeah, they do. The planning usually starts this time of year. Actually, they have a staff that works all year, and it happens in late August. Late August, early September, once schools, when students are back.
And what is the main purpose of the meeting? Just to just network and create partnerships, or to explore particular issues?
Well, Farm Science Review, it's how to describe it. I don't even know the numbers are. I mean, it's like almost like AGU. That size. Imagine you have 20 to 25,000 people coming in over 4 or 5 days to a site to go through an outdoor pavilion that would have everywhere from every dealer that sells agricultural products in the U.S., John Deere, Case, milking equipment, livestock equipment, all the extension agents from campus that specialize in stuff from fertilizer to planting soybeans, the big farm constituencies in the country, so Farm Bureau will be there, national and local and state. 4-H will be there. You'll have expositions of the equipment, so they'll actually have test plots set up where they can run combines downfield, they can do GPS stuff, they can display some of the equipment. Every big sales company from the state and some of the multi-state area will be there. And so the event's it's kind of the place to be. It's the AGU for the agricultural community in Ohio and a lot of the surrounding states. So every farmer knows if I go there, I'll get the up-to-date science. I can figure out what products I want to buy, and I can buy my combine at the same time and just have to make one visit to one location.
Yeah.
So it's even time to be just before crops are harvested in the fall. But it's something that I think they really wanted the state climatologist to be at in the past, and just the individual who had it, that wasn't something he pursued as much.
So who is the new state climatologist?
Brian Mark, who's in geography and also in our center, will be the state climatologist starting in the fall. Now, it's still not a funded position. We haven't got that worked out, but we're trying to figure out ways to get some funding behind it, but he definitely wants to play a more active role in helping communicate what's happening.
Great.
So that was our... Go ahead.
One thing to think about in the context of what you're talking about is the food resilience part of the U.S. Climate Resilience Toolkit as a new focus, an interagency focus there. But I'm imagining that a lot of the frames and strategies and resources that are there could be an input into the state level organization. The engagement, outreach, educational enterprise to do this work at a county state level is just not built. Lots of organizations have talked about building these between NIFA, which is the new name for the land grant extension framework at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and Sea Grant. I mean, they've been talking about this for years about how to build the local enterprises that you know, but build that within the context of climate and climate resilience and mitigation. And it's just not there. No one's been investing at this level. It's been all innovation kind of thought work, but not the enterprises. It's just not built to meet the demand, and it's going to take time. You know, think about the training to get these guys who are excellent at extension, for example, up to speed on this tricky science.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real stretch for them. And, just that whole enterprise is just not there. It's you know, we've been talking about this for years, but it's just, you know, and that's just one of our pieces, enterprises that relate to climate literacy. It's a bit of a stretch from normally what we talk about, but it's critical. And it's going to pivot and come our way really fast. And I think that everybody who's on the ground is experiencing it's already starting. And it's only going to get bigger, and yet the funding to make it happen is just not adequate at all.
Yeah.
And it takes time to build this up.
So, Frank, did you go to the Earth Day event in D.C.?
Did I?
Yeah.
I did. I was at the concert on the Mall and the World Bank event the day before.
Okay, so how did that go?
Well,
do you have any impressions?
Well, sure. I mean, I can give you one thing. I mean, as I was walking into the concert on the Mall on the 18th, which, you know, Usher and Train and Fall Out Boy and all that kind of stuff were there, there were 250,000 people screaming their heads off, being told that this is, you know, the beginning of Climate Education Week. That's what I heard when I was coming in. And, you know, I mean, from one perspective, that's amazing, right? I mean, you know, 10 years ago, to have, you know, 250,000 people in the Mall right in front of the White House, you know, being engaged on something called Climate Education Week, I couldn't have envisioned it. And so on one level, that sounds amazing, right? But when I look at the referrals from the website that supports this, you know, over that period of time, we only had 333 referrals from that website. I mean, that's, 250,000 to 333. It feels like we're making progress, but then when you actually look at the numbers,
This is from the Earth Day Climate Change Education Week website.
Yeah.
And
this is Climate Education.
Do you know how many
hits
their website actually got during the week?
I don't know that. I mean, we'll find that out. Tamara, you were also on the advisory board for that.
Right.
We'll find out, you know, through Johanna, and I think that they're a good partner to bring on board. But I think we can't be done with that initiative, after the climate week, because schools are spinning down at this time, not spinning up.
Right.
So really, it's the big push is the next academic year, not this one. I don't know any teacher who's opening up the door and starting new stuff at this point in time.
Yeah, and it is kind of late in the year. I'll have to look at the clean collection and see if there was any how many referrals we got.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's going to be small.
Yeah.
The marketing challenge we all face is another one that requires new partners, new resources. It's, you know, a skill set that we don't have, and I think that, you know, we're getting closer, but until those partners really come on, or the budget to bring those partners on come on, we're going to continue to be frustrated with, it looks good, but it actually isn't good yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's the best I've got. I mean, it's progress. It just doesn't feel like we've made enough progress to call success yet.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm crumpy today.
Oh, I know what that feels like.
It's okay.
Well, you know, I mean, we should just, feels like we should be, you know, where we are and where we could be, or just so far apart, and it's a frustration.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you about an event that I went to. My husband is at Bentley University. He runs the Center for the Integration of Science and Industry. And he had an Earth Day event that focused on sustainable seas, like meaning oceans. And so it started off with speakers that really talked about the oceans. From the CEO from the New England Aquarium was there, and a professor from Northeastern University was there. But then they transitioned into businesses that could potentially take advantage of the of the seas as well as conserve them. And so one of the debates, which I gather is going on, is this the issue around genetically modified food. So this one company has developed a genetically modified salmon. So I gather that salmon have their natural genus that they grow during a certain part of the year, and that gene turns off that mechanism during the colder part of the year. And what they did is they modified it so that it had another gene that turned on during the cold, the growth gene that turned on during the cold part of the year, such that the fish come to maturity in half the time that they would normally. And that they've proven that the salmon is perfectly fine, there's no danger to eating the salmon, and so on and so forth. But people are really worried about genetically modified food. So some of the debate is sort of along the lines of climate denial. And there's some people that have been supporters of the science for climate change for years, but deniers of the science for genetically modified foods. And some of them have managed to change their minds as a result of some of these conversations. So it was an interesting parallel to climate deniers is the issue about food sources and how to deal with that in the future.
Yeah, I've started talking about that with some of the presentations we make about denial can cross all political constituencies because you have vaccines, GMO, right. Climate, different political camps tend to deny different things.
Mm-hmm.
But at least I've noticed it gives people kind of a second to pause and reflect on, are they being internally consistent? And I think as far as the psychology of that tribal viewpoint, kind of some of the psychology behind why people think and identify with an exclusive group, and it makes them at least think about, are they falling for that same trap? And maybe give a little bit better ability to understand, articulate, communicate with people that would do that for some other area of science. I don't know. It's a definite time to pause and reflect on stuff, and I notice it seems to have an impact as people think through, are they being inconsistent themselves?
I can. I mean, I have a son who is has ADHD, and there's a process I had to go through with medication relative to that diagnosis. That I, as a very strong believer in use of scientific information for decision making, I found myself not having scientific chops to say I shouldn't medicate my son. Carefully do it, but I should, and a lot of literature and a lot of internet information was, saying it's food coloring, it's exercise, it's nature deficit, it's everything but medication. And, I had to have my own internal struggle come to the conclusion, do I support scientific information or not? And eventually I came down to I do. That's who I am. That's how I'm wired. So, but you see, my point is that the interface between scientific information and people, I think, is probably so much more prevalent than it's ever been. To have that internal process where you're really up against your own, do I really believe this, or do I only believe it in this camp but not in other places? I think that there's so many other instances where we're running up against scientific information that's controversial to our worldview, and it just happens, you kind of get exhausted by it. You know, whether it's, you name the issue.
Well, I think it reiterates, too, to some people, they don't have the toolkit to even know how to peruse that scientific literature. So if they don't understand the principles, they wouldn't even know, so what is a vetted source? Or what's, how do I rank credibility? I went out to school last Monday and Tuesday in an English class, and we took a series of 10 or 12 documents, everything from political cartoons to the IPCC report, the Heartland Institute. We ran off the executive summary of both, and we had students rank them by emotional appeal and by intellectual appeal. And the two that ranked most intellectual were IPCC and Heartland. And then we had to go through a long process of, based on what the student groups were saying, and this was a pretty advanced group of seniors, you know, what in these documents would you look for backing and warranting of a claim? And teasing everything out, and the extent to which they aren't prepared at their age with the experience they've had to discern an authentic, genuine science paper that's been peer-reviewed or is credible from one that isn't, they really don't have the toolkit to do that. And I think walking It was a great experience. I think we know how to improve it. I think getting more of those experiences into the hands of really good educators in English classes and science classes is going to be more and more important, because even outside the science realm, how do people discern credible claims from those that aren't? And I what I walked out was a lot more questions and a lot more notes on what I had seen to try to make things, improve things. But it was definitely a valuable experience, because most of the people on this call will have that toolkit. Mm-hmm. How do we build that in others?
Yeah, but the thing is that I think you're right. I think that being able to know where to go to get the information you need to make sure that you're making a decision that's based on science. But part of the problem is that because some of the information you need comes from such diverse fields, you may know where to go in certain realms and might not have any clue where to go in other realms. And being able to discern ways of finding credible information, not just vetting it once you've gotten to it, but being able to find it efficiently, because sometimes finding it, you may come across something and don't have the time to actually delve into making sure that it's credible. So, you know, there's all of these issues that come into play in trying to do that.
So, have you guys seen the there's a schematic that was developed between Common Core and NGSS. It's a three-circle Venn diagram that basically uses argumentation as the cross-cutting skill between those three domains. Have you seen what I'm talking about?
I think so. Can't remember
I vaguely think so. So you said three domains. It's Common Core, NGSS, and is there a third?
Well, because Common Core is math and ELA.
Oh, I see.
But one of the things I think, and I completely agree with the point that you know, that skill, when we called it out intentionally in the Climate Literacy Guide back in 2008, you know, being able to discern credible from non-credible sources. But, you know, somehow it never made it beyond, it's not in a, you know, a principle. It's been this weird hybrid, you know, it's floating out there, but it doesn't have it never made it into the actual thing we do as far as, you know, clean or stuff like that. The skill that we call for.
I don't think we have any activities around it.
Because we didn't transfer it. Put it in the document. We didn't put it in the principles and concepts.
Yeah.
But I think that it's part of the NGSS, the science and engineering practices.
Absolutely is. But it's weird, because if you look at it in the ELA, I think it's actually stronger in the Common Core side than it is in the science side. I think, you know, that your point, Jason, about where you do this in a school, I think you know English class is probably more where that skill is going to come from than science. I'm looking at the Venn diagram. I mean, you know, the demonstrate independence, reader, complex text, writing, speaking about them, build
stronger.
Do you have a
graphic, or do you have a link so that you could send to us?
Yeah, I have to find the exact graphic. I've got it. Yes. I got to find the original. I'll send it to you guys.
Yeah, that'd be good. Does sound familiar. I think the notion that just, you know, the notion of evidence being something that's just in English, I really think it also needs to be part of the science class, too, so it needs to be reinforced in both disciplines, in both cultures, if we want to go the whole two cultures thing. It's not just about English.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I completely agree with you, Scott.
Yeah.
Trying to find how, but the problem is that the standards don't really have
exactly.
You know, they don't have the connections as strong as here. I found it. I'll send it to you guys.
Good.
We're running our workshop again this summer for 4 days, and we've had people from all over the country getting a hold of us because we're using a grant to fund most of it. But 4 days on our argumentative writing, but it's really something that I think has to be immersive. And I think in a one of the best things that would help in a high school is being able to have an English teacher bring a science teacher that understands how the process works in to talk about it at the end. And the National Geographic article about a month ago was great. That talks about science denial because it almost mm-hmm. hits on everything you'd want to discuss in that conversation with the class or in the wrap up. But there definitely is a lot of interest in ELA. I know that for sure. We're getting a lot of language arts teachers from elsewhere getting a hold of us, and a lot of history teachers locally that have been trying to do this with some of the archival materials this university has.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this is so much of our focus has been on the content of science. Certainly the literacy principles are all on the content side. And what we're really starting to ask now is more philosophical questions and more process questions as we're talking about how to identify materials and then to be able to assess them in terms of decision-making. The whole thing that we are aware of, and frankly, you're sort of alluding to it, it's certainly part of the guiding principles in the climate literacy, but it's one of those things that's kind of frustrating. You know, it's sort of in there in NGSS, and it's in there in Common Core, but I guess we almost need a constituency that is promoting and really researching how do we teach these kinds of skills. I know when I was in philosophy, you know, this is certainly something that we did in, you know, the so-called baby logic courses where we talked about informal fallacies, talked about those kinds of relationships, but those were being given to philosophy students. It wasn't something that was given across campus, and yet it's foundational to virtually, any kind of discipline. And that's I'm talking undergrad level here, not in K-12.
To throw back to rhetoric, traditional rhetoric, not the
exactly we talked about
the we give it today.
Yeah, exactly, it's teaching of rhetoric.
Yeah.
But Scott, wouldn't you? I mean, one of the things I really like about the NGSS is the focus on progression, right? Yeah. Is that you know, if you're teaching these things at a higher level. Not everybody makes it to the higher levels, but at the same time, what are we doing at the elementary, middle, high school level that sets them up for that progression that they take further? I think it's fair to say that we're not doing a very good job right now at the primary level.
You know, and it's really all related to, you know, science and engineering practices. I mean, they're kind of there. But this, you know, we've talked about this quite a bit. Yes, we have the progression, but how do we entwine sort of the three elements, the three dimensions in there? never mind it in relationship to the two aspects of Common Core. I mean, this is the work for us, you know, as curriculum designers, is to figure out how to do that in a way that not only takes students along, but also takes teachers along, because this is also new learning for teachers. It seems pretty essential, and maybe this is the new piece of work that we need to do in the next couple of years.
Well, my gut feeling based on this conversation is that the stuff we're talking about is sitting in between stuff.
Yep.
And it's critical and missing. And if we don't do something differently, it's going to, you know, 10 years are going to go by and it's not going to make as big a difference.
Yep.
You know, I mean, one of the things we're working on right now is how to take this 100K in 10 challenge that I shared with you guys a little while ago about really focusing on how to teach the subject we're talking about across the curriculum. This is another perfect instance where, you know, the skills and content acquisition and time on this topic cannot sit in a earth science course alone or an environmental science course alone. It just won't work. It's a all subjects, great education prepares you for climate change. That's it. Not just the science stuff, which is critical. I mean, I'm a science teacher, but I'm just saying that we sometimes operate at, you know, we only focus on the science teachers, and they are only part of the puzzle, not the whole thing.
Yep.
Yeah, because there isn't always inevitably some new thing that comes up that we'll be having. I mean, if anybody saw Merchants of Doubt, you could argue we're in the fourth or fifth cycle of the same denial camp coming back with the same arguments. And so you could really cut to the chase by just saying if we have really good reasoning, we can stop the next problem before it arises. Because there will be something else that comes up in the future where we're having the same conversation over again, unless people know how to reason better.
Yeah, right. It's just out of curiosity, does that line I just laid out, I've said it a couple times over the years, but this idea that, you know, to prepare students and citizens for the challenges and opportunities that climate change presents, you need a great education. Does that resonate with you guys?
Yeah.
Yes, it does. But you have to define great education a little bit more, because you want a great education for somebody who's not going to be going into the sciences as a career. And
I want a great education
so much
for everybody. I understand
what?
That, but the reason why I'm saying it is because a lot of times in, you know, when we were at the National Academies, having the, you know, you should see I have a shelf full of documents that we've talked about this in, a whole one, you know, which is great. We have a lot of literature, but it isn't until recently that we really started talking about widening the focus set beyond just the science enterprise, the science museums, the science parts, the science classrooms, in order to do what we laid out in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting evolution. But
well, I don't
know.
I think that it was really inherent in the document that came out in 2008.
Well, not really. I mean, in all the subsequent conferences and meetings, and, you know, we haven't been at the, I imagine English teachers have a professional society that they're part of that's not NSPA. I don't even know the name of it, let alone.
So I guess what I'm saying is it's there, it's just not been implemented across it as well. So I would agree with that.
I agree.
Well, our conversation
that's one of the things that we want to address through our collective impact activities.
Mm-hmm.
Is to try to engage that broader group beyond the sciences.
The only reason some of the conversation started in Ohio is there's a colleague of mine who I taught professional development workshops for years with the Board of Regents grant, and she had started collaborating with some of the English teachers because of writing. And just started something very informal. Well, she became a vice principal, and she saw something that all the teachers were doing that was so good with reasoning. She said, "Here's a book. You got to read it." I mean, it is the exact same thing for English that we were trying to do for science. And we had a historian on campus that we were doing some PD with, and we said, "Hang on, he's doing the same thing here. Like, so it's just triangulating and saying English and history and what we were doing in science all had overlap. And everybody that has had these conversations here amongst those three camps were all so shocked that we were so close. The vocabulary was a little different, but we hadn't had these conversations a decade or more ago. We're still kind of recovering from that and still finding the depth of the connections that are there. But for some reason, just because of the disciplines, there was absolutely no conversation between the different camps.
Yeah. A recognition of similarity, but no action based on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody from the university, people I work with, the high school teachers, are still reeling from the fact we are, at the very core, this similar in how the reasoning process happens. And mm-hmm. it's putting people in a room, though, and flushing out, here's examples, so when those educators leave your workshop, you can say, these are four things that specifically look like what I want to create. Now, can I do this for more things in my class? And giving them a toolkit, some resources to use to build those, or making sure they know who to call if they have more ideas. But we have a small community here that's starting that process. But it's definitely been an organic process. We didn't go in with any kind of overarching structure, and we've been very impressed with what's happened as we've seen the natural connections.
Where are you in that project?
it's not a funded project so much. So what we did last year is we applied to the Ohio Humanities Council for a grant to run a workshop, charging I think $60, basically to cover food, lunch costs and parking costs. And we took it out of a donation we had and ran the workshop to say, oh, what the heck, you know, for 5 days we can do this once. Our archives kicked in some money, and we kicked in some money from Bird. And we had two English teachers come in that had done this in their class, and we ran it with some history examples from our archives, a science one that I wrote up, and one I used from NSTA, and stuff they were already doing in English from a really, really phenomenal book that a lot of the English community is becoming aware of now. And then we're running it again this summer for 4 days, and
what's the focus of the workshop again?
Argumentative writing for science, English, and social studies. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to advertise it as a way to bring in primary sources to address the Common Core, but also improve reasoning skills in class. And we've had a lot of people sign up again this year as a team of two teachers. So, like, we had three teams come last year that were two different disciplines from various schools. But already we've only had advertising for probably less than a month, and we already have 15 or 16 signed up, which is the entire section we ran last year. But of those, three are from outside the state, and I've got six other people that email me this week from outside Ohio. Because we can fund anybody to come here. It's $30. You got to pay for lodging if you're outside Central Ohio. But everybody who runs it, the facilitators even, the English teachers think it's phenomenal because they never thought that what they do in English really mattered that much for the sciences or how people discern fact from non-fact and make sense of things as an average citizen reading scientific information. So it's definitely something now that we're in our second year field testing. I think we'll be ready to kind of expand and share with others, but it's been really exciting to watch the process happen because we really didn't know what to expect going in. And we all acknowledged that last year. We told all the participants, you know, this is a guinea pig program. It's going to be a little different, but here's what we'll deliver. And we had very, very positive reviews from individuals.
Nice.
So
Jason, I'm actually just looking at the webpage for your workshop. I'm just wondering I just think there should be other folks, especially on this network, that sort of hears about your experience with all of this and kind of, you know, carry on this kind of conversation we've been having this morning, at least this morning here. And maybe we should do something in the fall. I'm thinking maybe after rather than before. The other thing that I'm interested in, you mentioned that there's a particular book that's being used quite a bit in English that supports some of this material. I don't know if you've got that. I was wondering whether it's actually on the website. I don't see it as a
The book I would recommend, it's a phenomenal book. It's Argumentative Writing, Grades 7 through 12, okay, by a University of Chicago professor. But I'll give you more about him. His last name is Hillux. H-I-L-L-O-C-K-S. And it's on Amazon.
Okay.
The best thing about, and I, this is why I love this book so much, because my colleague gave it to me. This gentleman didn't want to write a book. He was a former, I think, English teacher in a school up in the Cleveland area, went back and started the University of Chicago as basically a rhetoric teacher, and was worked in the Chicago City Schools with his grad students for years, 20 years. He didn't want to write a book. Basically, he didn't think he had a lot of... The best educators are sometimes the ones that don't think they have anything special to share because it's just so ingrained in how they practice. And a few of his former students know, you have something that's really special. You need to put it on paper. You need to give the examples. So the book talks a bit about theory, but really gives concrete examples. He's used in inner-city schools. And the educators we work with, that's where they started, and they've really built from that book. Some of them, and their whole department, is using it now. And the results were, there's a lot of very esoteric things like warranting in English that were very difficult to teach. And this book tells you specific ways to do it and gives you things that are accessible to a 7th or 8th grader. It doesn't have to be really theoretical. And knowing this, it would have made my AP biology students such better writers. You know good writing when you see it, but you sometimes don't know what makes it so well done. And this has helped me think about my own writing as a writer, and I feel like I can write pretty well, but this has definitely made me reflect on my own writing even. The book is so well done. And it's a very fast read. It's only 120, 30 pages long. But I would encourage anybody to read it. Go ahead.
Well, one question for you about this is the emphasis on writing is curious to me because, I mean, in a citizen perspective, especially given what we were talking about with Merchants of Doubt, it's also in dialogue, listening, and reading, and writing. And does this cover that all those modalities, you know, building that skill as a transferable skill between the reading, writing, listening, and dialogue space?
It does, and I would say, the educators we work with really want the writing in there, in the title. I think it covers all of them. There's a lot of deliberate writing they do in it because they want to have something tangible to go ahead and then deconstruct. And if it's oral, it's harder to do that. So it's not just writing. There's a lot of dialogue that happens in the workshop and a lot of justification, but you need to have something in print in order to be able to dissect it. Either something that the participants are dissecting somebody else wrote or their own work. But writing is used to learn in this case. It's not the final product. You're not trying to make a phenomenal writer. You're trying to get them to reason, and the writing is a way to support their development as a reasoner, orally, in print, whatever the medium.
Gotcha. I appreciate that.
I just got the book, and in fact, there is the first chapter of the book is actually available online, so... giving some of the background.
Can you shoot that around?
I'd be interested in seeing that also. I am going to have my taxi is here now, so I'm going to have to leave, but you guys can continue talking.
Thank you, Tamara. Right. See you tomorrow.
All right. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
That's great, Tamara. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I can send. Do you want me to send around the Amazon link to everyone?
Yeah, sure. And if you know this, do you have the link? For the first chapter?
Workshop.
Okay, I'll send around now. Yep.
So there's a PDF.
I think socializing the work you're doing as an innovation on some of the work that we've been doing for a very long time in the field is an important expansion of the way and how and the who in our group. You know, I mean, Noah's running four workshops, regional workshops. Scott, were you at all involved in the Seattle one that happened last week?
I know Lisa and some of the folks. I just looked at the content and said, okay, this is really not for me. And I didn't actually talk to Lisa that maybe I could help. So I'm just the one in Seattle.
I got that. But my point is that some of these innovations have not made it into practice yet. So I think normalizing is a really important part of this. And so you guys have been doing it there, so let's try and promote it wider.
Okay. Well, send out everything now, and then we'll in the fall, we'll be happy to share what we've had from the second summer's workshop.
That would be great.
Experience we've had. But we're definitely getting a good core of people here and kind of building a network. So I think we'll be ready to share a lot more once the summer's concluded.
That's great.
And this, like I said, this is a pretty informal project. It's, I think, definitely scalable because of the disciplines involved. And I think because the lessons are very, nothing's esoteric. It's immediately transferable to a classroom in multiple disciplines. And it's kind of a good example for what people are shouting for the Common Core. But especially younger educators don't know what a good lesson looks like that addresses these topics. And there's plenty of examples in this community to show.
You know, there's a guy, Joe Heimlich. Do you know him?
Yeah. He was at Ohio State. He works with COSI. He's an extension agent as well.
Joe, but he's also an evaluator.
Yep.
So the reason I bring up Joe in this context, I know we're wrapping up, is one of the things Joe and I were talking about was skill development in the context of, you know, environmental education and science education. And he made the case that a skill, sometimes there's literature that supports the fact that if you build a skill in a class, it isn't a transferable skill, meaning a skill that is applied to other things for learners until they build the skill with some content, and then you intentionally rework on that skill on another topic, and to really solidify that this skill. Sometimes we bin a skill inside of the content, so if we're not working on that content, that skill doesn't apply.
Yeah, that's true.
So if you really, you know. And what you're working on right here is already built to build transferable skill, to build the skill, but then also to build that skill in multiple domains and reinforce that skill in multiple domains so it becomes a transferable, more enduring, more useful and used skill. So if that's interesting to you, you might want to reach out to Joe and talk to him about the literature base for that nugget he gave me so many years ago.
Okay. Yeah, Joe's a good guy. I'll run that by him because that's actually in education, that's a well-known phenomenon even in physics ed and in science ed. But getting that transference up increases the likelihood to use the skill. So that's kind of the holy grail.
I mean,
if you do that, you know you're successful in teaching a skill.
Yeah. You're teaching a student, not a subject.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. You know, and this is where a team of teachers are involved because sometimes that skill development is reinforced by another teacher somewhere else. But that doesn't happen by accident. Well, it actually happens by accident too often.
And Frank, that goes back to your point earlier about sort of the cross-feed between science education around this kind of, you know, argumentative writing and in English. The idea of being able to do that in the whole school is also another way of reinforcing this idea of transferring of skills and understanding, being able to demonstrate what you've learned in English in your science class, that kind of stuff. But that takes enormous
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Scott, so many times when I was teaching, somebody would say, you know, a student would say, oh, I think I understand what you're doing. That's what, like, you know, Judy down the hall was doing last week in that class. And I'm like, I had no idea you were working on that somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, we had that with
everything.
We had a STEM program that we had tech, math, and science that we finally were able to collaborate for the first year. And during our summer, we all realized we all taught slope using different terminology for the same concept. And all of us couldn't figure out why we were fighting so hard because none of the students were transferring any of the information to the different classes. And so we finally agreed on common terminology, decided who would do what. We explicitly build on the other course in the right sequence and make sure we are mentioning the examples when they'd be using the other courses. And we all realized we were saving time. You could do so many things in greater depth, and you could practice in greater depth so they retained it. Because I took 2 weeks to do something that would have taken a week, but then I offloaded something else to another teacher to do that I would have had to invest time with. But there was never, before that program, there'd never been time to do that, to plan explicitly what people would collaborate.
My favorite book is by Kenneth Brophy called Collaborative Learning. It's recognizing that each sort of the disciplines has their own set of language, their own set of essentially a culture. And part of what we're doing in learning is that we are bringing students essentially to join a community which also has its own language and culture. So this is kind of another example of different communities, different learning communities, and you're having to essentially negotiate meaning between those communities. And for students who are new to all this, you're basically asking them to join three different communities which seem to be talking about the same thing, but it's not clear at all because they're using the terms in different ways. So as educators, we kind of have to do, I think, that work probably for our students before we ask them to discern the difference between them. Multidisciplinary stuff.
Well, this is why I'm trying to socialize that idea of a great education, right?
Yeah.
I think,
yeah.
You know, like you said, you great writing, you know when you see it. I think we all know when schools are really operating in this way, that just like that slope example you're using, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that requires coordination, offset, conversations across domains for a purpose, which is enhanced education for your ultimate, you know, for the students. All too often that doesn't happen, you know, and I think that's one of the key things to our success, making that happen more.
Yeah.
So
I guess we got to scoot.
Nice chatting, everyone. I'll drop a message here in a second. I'm just composing it now.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Jason.
Thank
and
you.
Frank.
Enjoy the nice weather.
Hope.
Take care, Frank.
Yeah.
Very good. Thanks, everyone.
Take care, guys.
Yeah.
Bye.
You too. Keep safe.
That's right.